Welcome to the Oxley Bond MotoGP podcast.
Hello, everybody. It's the Oxley Bond MotoGP podcast again with me, ancient racer, ex-racer, ancient journalist, Matt Oxley, and my podcast partner,
Peter Bohm, slightly less old, always data recording, sometimes crew chief, and currently part-time journalist, trying that.
And we just want to say a quick thank you for, you know, we're in the deep off-season, aren't we? And we're still getting between 6,000 and 7,000 downloads off you guys every week. So thanks for that a lot, because I know, you know, in the winter, a lot of people lose a bit of interest. So we're quite happy with those figures. Yeah, tell your friends. And in a couple of weeks, we'll be opening a Patreon site or whatever you call it, so you can throw some money at us if you feel like it. Right, so what are we going to talk about this week? Well, we're going to talk about a fantastic subject, something that fascinates everybody that races motorcycles and everybody that watches motorcycle racing, and that is crashing. You know, I am 99.9999999% sure there's never been a motorcycle racer who has never crashed in his or her career. So, you know, crashes are 100% a part of motorcycle racing, and they can go from the very funny to the absolute tragic. We all know that. What we want to talk about here is kind of, you know, why do riders crash, and what's the most important background information about crashing, and, you know, what do you see on data when somebody crashes, and all that kind of stuff. By the way, we put a load of crash statistic graphics on our Twitter feeds, or X if you prefer, so you can actually look at the numbers and stuff that we're going to be talking about. And if you don't know where we are on Twitter, I'm at Matt Oxley, and Peter is at Peter Bohm, number four. So, I mean, looking at the crash stats from last year, you know, there's the kind of list of shame, if you like, of the number of crashes scored by all the riders. And the podium is, the winner is Marc Marquez on 29 crashes, his worst ever. Aaron Canet in Moto2 with 24 crashes. And Joan Mir, Marquez's teammate, on 24 crashes also. And then obviously the, you know, the Repsol Honda thing, that tells a story. And that's the whole point of this pod, you know, that you can get a lot of information out of not only how many races a rider wins, but by how many times he crashes. So yeah, so I actually did the math, and Marquez crashed during his 10 years with Honda, or 11 years with Honda, he crashed 196 times during 169 race weekends. But the important thing is, during that time, he won 59 Grand Prix and 6 world titles. And the only guys that have ever done more than that are Valentino Rossi and Giacomo Agostini. So what does that tell you? The vast majority of his crashes were not in races. They were when in practice, when he was trying to find the limit for the race, so that then he would know where it was. So I'm going to fire over to Peter now. Why do you think Marquez crashed so many times? I mean, you know, it's more than once a weekend throughout his 11 years with Honda, when he was winning and losing, you know.
Well, Marquez crashes because that's in Mark's DNA, crashing. Always going. It's easy to say that he did it to find the limit, and in a way that's true, but I remember him from when he was young. He was always crashing. I think it was the race that he went to win his 125 world title. He even crashed on the sighting lip. You know, the guy just crashes. And all he learned over the years, and that's very, very important, he knows that he can get away with it usually. The guy has reflexes that are unbelievable, and as long as he keeps these reflexes there, he gets away by just throwing it on his knee and doing whatever he wants with the bike, and then deal with the results, because he usually could. But first of all, it's in his nature. The guy is like quite fighty, as Paul Espargaro used to tell us lately, quite fighty, so he always is up there. I was shocked when he came back from his major injuries, and he was in Portimao in free practice one on a drying track that he even went out. But I was shocked to see how he was riding when he went out, because that was like plain stupid. That's not like, okay, I have to feel, no, that's immediately. And that told me, and I've seen more afterwards, that it's not just on purpose. The guy has no other way as riding it. It's actually unbelievable the amount of self-control he has when it's usually race time, and then he just not crashes, and then he's really, really fast when everything was working well with the Honda and his hard front tires. But ever since that's not longer the case, he keeps crashing and trying. So yeah, okay, he's on a Ducati, but that's another podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Last time I interviewed him was at Sepang last October, November. And he was sort of telling us that, you know, in his final months with Honda, that he was, you know, he said, oh, I was really trying to, you know, realize that it was a kind of hopeless situation. So he would just try not to crash. And he said, so I tried riding in safety mode, but it was so boring. You know, he actually likes that buzz.
Exactly.
You get from being on the edge and kind of basically saving a crash and going on and saving another crash. And that's the buzz he gets, you know. And I think one of the reasons he often crashed was because he was used, which we'll go into why, he was often trying hard front tire in practice because the Honda, because he made all the speed with the front hammering into corners, he had to, most of the time he had to use a hard front, and so he was testing that in practice. And it's much easier to crash with a hard tire than it is with a soft tire, something we'll explain in a minute. And another thing, if you're just looking at the crash statistics in general over the years, they come up with some amazing numbers. The statistics that tell us how many, the average number of crashes per MotoGP weekend, this is in the premier class, right? So in 2006, the average number of crashes in the MotoGP class per weekend was 5.7. Last year, it was 17.9. So if I'm any good at maths, that's a 300% increase, I think. And what are the reasons for this? There's various reasons. The lap times are a lot more closer. It's much more competitive now. So, you know, 10 years ago or whatever, if you were 10, 12 years ago, if you were half a second off pole time in qualifying, it didn't matter. You know, you could spend all weekend working up to that time until Saturday afternoon. It didn't matter. If you were half a second off, it didn't matter. You'd still be on the second row. At Valencia last year, if you were half a second off the front row, off pole position, you were on the fifth row. So, you know, these guys are going out to get, risking everything to find tenths, hundredths, even thousands. There's another reason, that the switch to the 15-minute qualifying format in 2015. So basically, you have to qualify in the last practice session. You're trying to get into Q2. So you're already risking everything. And that's obviously got even worse because of the sprint race format. And finally, the tracks are safer. So you can crash. It doesn't matter, you know, unless you're paying the crash bills. If you're the rider, you're like, well, I've got to risk it. And I'm just, you know, I'm not going to hit anything. So it's not the crash total that matters, actually. What really matters is the injury total, you know, which is something we don't have the data for. I mean, Peter, what, you're a data man, obviously. What do you see on the data when a rider loses the front and crashes? What happens to the squiggles?
Oh, Gary is again with me as a data guy. We kept it away for a month, but now since we did the throttle thing last week, you're fully on me. And now I have to explain everything with the computer. And when the computer says it's right, but you got to be careful. But yeah, it's not fun. But at the same time, sometimes it is fun looking at the computer for crashes. So you ask me the front end. Obviously, I have no current MotoGP data, that because I don't work in a MotoGP team, but I've seen a lot of different bikes, and I have had a lot of crashes in my career that I had to study, because what every rider hates is crashing and not really knowing why. And I think 80% of the time they know why, 20% of the time they admit it. But the 20% that's left and they really don't know why, you have to find it. Because it's such a downer and it's such a dent in your confidence. If you really were sure you did nothing else, you really would love to hear from somebody else, even from another, yeah, there was oil on the track. Oh, thank God, because when I wasn't even really, really fast and still I'm on my ass, and I can't have that because it's already a shitty weekend and so on. So front end losing the front end data, Matt, there is roughly two ways, I have to say, first, how you can lose the front. Let's start with it simply sliding away from you. That's a simple one. When you're already on a lot of banking angle, more or less close to the neutral phase in the corner, where you have your elbow on the ground and you're staring like Colin Edwards style, like to where the track will go, wringing your neck. And at that moment, it can just gently moves away from you, the front. It doesn't do anything drastic, but there's also no saving. You just lose it. That is on data actually not so easy to see, because initially nothing happens, because you're already on 50 degree banking angle and you stay on 50 degree banking angle and the wheel speeds don't change a lot. It's just that suddenly you are trapped between the fairing and the track, and suddenly shortly after that, everything, you know, wheel speeds. And probably the first thing that you normally notice studying data is the front fork extending where it should not extending. That's the first thing that happens before you, Matt, feel your hands moving away from you. It's the front that already tire has gone, taking the lower part of the front fork, but not giving you the feedback. So that's why it feels like slowly and removed, and it's gone, you know? The other one is a harder one, but maybe you want to say something about these slow crashes.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, why does the suspension extend? Because the bike's no longer carrying a load, because the bike, it's not sticking to the tarmac, it's sliding away, so there's no load. So the suspension, yeah, extends and down you go. So next one, keep going.
Yeah, usually, to give you a number, when we have a front fork that has like a 125 millimeter stroke, which is an average stroke from almost every front fork, then mid-corner on a typical bike, and then I'm with mid-corner, I mean you're off the brakes, but not on the gas yet. That's the time that you'll take as short as possible, and that's the time that the rider is praying that the forker will turn by itself because you don't do anything else. You're just sitting on it. It feels like floating a little bit. Suspension in the front is still at 50 millimeter deep, so, and this shows you that there is quite some load on it, that you push it on just a couple of millimeters rubber on the side. And if that rubber loses the grip, the first thing that happens is the front fork is extending, and then afterwards the whole bike is more or less just falling down. Now, there is another type of front, losing the front, and that's probably known by you as well, which is when it sort of tucks in. Means you're on your knee probably already or just before you have your knee on the ground, and suddenly in the right-hand corner, the handlebars turn a lot more to the right. You know, that's actually when you can save it, it's when you make a black line. Usually, even if you don't save it, basically, you're laying a black line. Because what you do, suddenly the front tire turns in a lot more than it needs to do for that corner, creating a braking effect. So suddenly you're braking, taking away speed a lot by putting the front tire more or less square on the line of direction where you're actually going. Like I said, sometimes when you're a bit lucky, you can pick it up again. If you quickly with your knee, or if you're just lucky with the tire and with the track, how it goes, you can pick it up again and whoa, that was a biggie, leaving black lines. But usually that's it. And that's the thing that you see. If you ask me about the data recording, the way I can distinguish these two front end crashes is that when it tucks in, it sort of seems to lock. You have a short dip in the front wheel speed, where the rear wheel speed and the GPS speed and all your calculation speed channel are simply continued because the bike still has a reasonable good, has its normal mid-corner speed, but it's like grabbing a front brake, like blocking it shortly. So that's the first thing that happens. After that, yeah, depending on if riders try to save it or not, a lot of other stuff can happen. But yeah, it's a dip in the front wheel speed that shows me that it's tucking away. And while we're at it, Matt, now I have a crew chief style question for you. When we were struggling trying to find if our bike was actually too much over the front or not enough over the front, one of the things I would sometimes ask my rider is, okay, so when you're in this long-lasting third gear corner, what do you think, how does it feel for you? Is it about to tuck or is it about to just move away from you, the front? And that's the type of question, as silly as it sounds, it usually makes the rider think again, trying to remember how it felt, and 8 out of 9 times they come back with the correct answer. And that tells me if we are already way too heavy over the front or not enough, and so on and so on. So that's a way of gathering information from the rider sometimes. Just tell me what you think is about to happen. Don't ask that to a 17-year-old kid, but the riders that are a little bit more experienced, you see them thinking, and yeah, then they know what it is about to be going to do. And that's vital information for me when we're just not crashing yet.
Yeah, and great stuff. I love hearing what, you know, exactly what's going on when you're crashing. Something I don't do very often these days. And I mean, we're talking about front end crashes. We are going to get on to rear end crashes, which, as most of us know, are much nastier generally. But, you know, obviously most crashes now, the vast majority of crashes front end, especially MotoGP, because, you know, the traction control generally looks after the rear. Not always, but sometimes, mostly. But, you know, the number of crashes can tell you so much about what a rider's getting from his motorcycle and how he's getting on with it. If we think about, look at Valentino Rossi. When he went from Yamaha to Ducati, he went from crashing 3 times a year on average on the Yamaha to crashing 12 times in 2011. And he used to call the moment that he lost the front the fucking bat black hole. and I know what he means. You know, if you lose the front, you get this horrible feeling in your stomach. And it's a bit like if you've ever been in a plane and the plane hits an air pocket and just drops by 50 meters in a second. It's like the earth is falling away from you. It's a horrible, horrible feeling. And they look at Rossi in 2003 when he won 11 of 16 races on the Honda's RC211V. He crashed once all year just because his bike was so good and that none of his rivals were super fast. So he was basically cruising. And the other time when he won 11 races was in 2005 on the Yamaha M1. He crashed 5 times, which basically shows, although he won the same amount of races, he was probably having to push a little bit more to keep ahead of the other guys. And what we just talked about, why do you crash on a soft front or a hard front? What are the differences? And basically, I'm trying to put it in easy to understand language here. The way tires grip, I mean, people say by friction, but yeah, it's sort of more than that. It's the way the rubber sort of meshes, kind of interlocks with the grain of the asphalt. It's like kind of, you know, literally gripping it, hanging onto it. And obviously a soft rubber, presuming you don't go too soft, is going to grip those grains better than a hard rubber. I mean, that's kind of pretty obvious to see, I think. And when you lose, certainly from my experience, you know, when you lose the front on a soft tire, it's much easier to feel and hopefully get back than when you lose the front tire, a front tire on a soft tire. And I think you know all about that, Peter, don't you? About how much most riders hate hard front tires. So can you tell a bit like why do they hate hard tires, hard fronts?
They don't hate front tires. They don't hate hard front tires. They hate the word hard. It's stupid, but it's I can understand it at the same time completely because it sounds just wrong. But what if the current soft tire is just way too soft, you know? It's moving around all the time and like sliming over the tarmac. Then it's just nothing. Then a harder tire or a less soft tire, we should say to some riders, is just what you want. Because perfect grip depends on the perfect combination, the perfect storm between the chemistry, the chemical compound of the rubber and how it interacts with this tarmac on this temperature at the moment. How it really, I don't know really the English word for each other, but then it really interferes, grabs into it and stay there. And when it loses it, that it does it not so aggressively. That's the perfect situation with seldom occurs. Yeah, I know riders hate it when you say harder tire. So one of the things I usually did, I normally did before the weekend, when we prepare the weekend in information, I tell them, okay, this is the allocations of tires we have. And one is usually called soft, one is called medium, one can be called hard. And I always look to put it in perspective saying, okay, don't worry, because what is called hard here is normally, for example, our medium tire, or is the tire that we used to race last year. You know, you remember you had a good race here last time. You have to tell them something, because the word hard is always wrong. Riders are very primitive in this, and being, you know, I can understand it from their point of view. You don't want to hear that. But if your tire is too soft, there is such a thing as too much feedback when the tire is already, you know, the first turn you go in, you already think, whoa, that's a lot of understeer. You're careful for a couple of corners, and then you push a little bit more and you just feel understeer. Because that's what tires do, that grip not so good, but don't make you crash. They just understeer. It's like going with your car on a roundabout to fully locking the steering quickly, you know, to whatever. Then it just goes wide. So, and that's how bikes can feel. It's lovely because it doesn't make you crash, but it's frustrating because it's also slow. It's really, really slow. So you want to have a tire that's the best of in between. And that's not so easy nowadays. But yeah, hard tires, when it grips perfectly, it's good. But in the end, a tire that is either by carcass or by compound, a little bit on the soft side, tend to give just more feedback. So if you even for the moment forget in this story the lap time itself, then it's just easier to handle. It's just easier to handle because it tells you a lot of tales. It's even screaming right in your face, stop it, I'm about to lose it. So if you ignore that and you really want to crash, feel free, but there is not a lot of excuses when you come back to the box. When you crash, you ignored everything. And Moto2, Moto3, especially Moto2, Matt, are in for a surprise this year, actually, because they are from Dunlops, and Dunlops used to give little feedback. They were quite rigid tires, hard carcass, didn't deform a lot, and it's usually the deformation of the carcass that gives you the most feedback. Again, if you overdo it, it's also really, really wrong, but usually the Dunlop don't give a lot of feedback, but people forget, because also, again, a hard carcass sounds wrong. No. Because a hard carcass, especially the front but also the rear, makes the bike like nimble, like quickly to change direction, because it doesn't need to unfold the tire from one side to the other tire. It's just flip-flop, you go over left-right, like a Moto3 like always does. Even big bikes can do that if you put pretty stiff tires under them. So it makes it easier to quickly change direction and immediately go where you want to go. But as a rule of thumb, the feedback is just a little bit less. And it's always, in my memory, it used to be a good sign if my riders ask and prefer the harder tire, because that for me showed that he understands the benefit from it and thinks he can deal with the downside from it. He has a very good sense, a very good feeling for the limit, which obviously you have to love in a rider.
Yeah, and just to give people I didn't push the front tire habitually when I was racing. I wasn't that good. But I did it a few times. And just to kind of explain to people what it feels like, if you're going into a right-hander, you feel the tire starting to smear across the asphalt. And so you're lent hard right. And you can feel the tire kind of crabbing, going sideways across the tarmac. So you're going right and the tire's going left. So what do you do to stop that turning into a crash? Well, you literally hold your breath. You know, you just try to stay 100% static on the motorcycle. You don't want to put any input in it at all. Just not let go of everything, but just not put any more load into the front. Don't move, don't anything, and just pray that it just holds and grips and you carry on around the corner. And it's funny, as a racer, if you race motorbikes, you'll probably have felt this as well, that you end up obviously dreaming about racing. If you race motorbikes, you dream about racing. And when you crash, you wake up with this huge start, you know, like jump. I've talked to a lot of racers about this and they all, and I was the same. They all only have one kind of crash in their dreams. You know, you're either a front ender in your dreams or a high sider. I was a low sider, always. Never high sided in a dream, always a low side. And you know, you'd be sitting on a plane or whatever, and you'd jump up, you know, and people would look around you like you're a kind of madman or something. It was quite funny. So let's move on to the nasty kind of crashes now, which is high sides. So what do you see on the data, you know, suspension travel and all that kind of stuff, wheel speed, you know, when a rider high sides? I mean, it presumably is a lot more spectacular on the curves on the screen than a low side.
You don't let go with the data. Like the real ones are easier, Matt, because that's a simple thing. If you look at the difference between the front and rear wheel speed, there is a certain average slip level that you normally have exiting that corner. It can be any number that's at the moment valid for that bike and that track and that corner. And you see a sequence of things. It starts with RPM, together with the rear wheel speed, suddenly raising a lot more than can be. The front speed and all the calculated speeds are still there, immediately followed, but that immediately has to be in time, by the throttle trace hesitating or already going backwards. That's the moment when everybody and the rider on top of it realize, oh shit. If you're lucky, there's just a moment of nothing and then gently opening the throttle again and that's it. If you're unlucky, the next thing you see, because we normally don't measure steering angle, how much you put the steering to the left or to the right. Because if you do a proper high side, it will go completely to the limit because the bike's square underneath you. But we normally don't measure that. I think at the moment they do that. But let's forget about that. What happens is the rear steps out, and that's because we see it in the rear wheel speed coming up quickly. But the next thing that can happen if you're just too late is that the rear suspension compresses like crazy. Like, I tell you something, normal rear shocks on super sport super bikes, once a lap on the usual tracks, I don't say branch heads because that's not a usual track, I don't say Sachsenring, but normal tracks, you go somewhere, every lap your maximum travel is 32, 36 millimeters, for example. And after 35 millimeters, you're hitting the bump rubber. Now, the bump rubber is 10, 12 millimeters thick, you can compress it to 4, but you shouldn't get there. The bump rubber is there only because you're high siding it. So when you're high siding it, suddenly you go to maximum travel, even when the suspension seems to become completely flat for a short moment. That's when you know the shit is about to hit the fan, because that all that energy needs to come back, and it throws you, it flies you to the moon. That's also how it feels. It sends you to the moon. So you're there in the right hand corner. Suddenly you see that you're looking to the inside of the corner. And the next time you realize that you get somebody hits you under your ass, and you're hanging above the thing. And in data, like I said, the first thing you notice is rear speed coming up with the RPM and the rear wheel speed both together. Quickly jump up, followed by a rider that is trying to close the throttle in time. Then the rear suspension completely compresses, and after that, sometimes it's silent for seconds. All the suspension is completely extended, so the thing is in the air, and so on, and so on, and so on. So, yep, that's how it looks.
Can you explain nice and simply why does the rider end up? I mean, I know the bike gets thrown up as well, but it's a lot heavier, and you know. But how are the forces generated that throw the rider up into the air, which can be 2 meters, you know. I mean, some of the ones you see are like really horrible. But what are the forces that flicks the rider into the air?
That comes basically from the rear spring that is loaded maximum. So the rear suspension is loaded a lot more, even more than it does on your super pole qualifying lap. It loads completely in, and then bam, comes completely back. And if you don't anticipate that in time by, for example, coming up from the bike and bending from your knee, motocross style, then because if you do that really quickly, you sort of put a damper in between. You still will get off the seat, but probably not as high. But if you're just sitting there like a sack of potatoes, not completely realizing what's actually happening, that's the worst. Because the more static you are on the bike, the harder it hits you in your ass when you get one. I know.
yeah, we all know.
I'll tell you maybe later.
But also the fact that the tire's sliding and then it grips, that kind of gives a whiplash effect, doesn't it? That's also part of what sends you to the moon, isn't it? Or not? I don't know.
Yeah, it starts by, like, take a right-hand corner. The rear suddenly goes completely wide and comes almost around you, which, if you're lucky, is what it does. Because then we call it the low side. Then you just lost the rear. There I came away very, 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 very nice. I mean, it's a crash, but it's nothing. But if it just before you think, okay, now I'm going to hit the tarmac, if it suddenly just grips again, and it can, because suddenly the whole tire is like more or less 90 degrees of the angle of how the motorbike is traveling. So yeah. If you put a rear wheel suddenly like 90 degrees on I don't know how to say it, like square or something, in the riding direction, it will grip at some point. So if you have this unlucky situation that you lose it, but then because it's on nearly on a 90 degree angle of the tarmac, it suddenly desires to grip again, that's very, 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 very bad. That's when things get dangerous, because that grip means the tire stops, but the bike was moving violently outside. So all the energy from you, sack of potatoes on top of it, and the rest of the bike, and the speed that it has, all this energy goes in the rear spring, and it goes way faster than it ever is supposed to be. We're going in the bump stop that Erlins really put there for that occasion. Otherwise, you will damage your shock. And then it comes back afterwards. So if it comes back, it hits you so hard.
Yeah, I think Peter and I have both experienced high sides a few times, and they're pretty much the worst thing that can happen to you in racing. We're going to bore you a little bit about our own experiences, because also if you can talk from a personal perspective, gives a kind of better idea. I mean, I had loads of fucking high sides, and everyone was just horrible. I mean, you know, and don't do this. You know, it's like climbing on top of a car in in leathers and a helmet, and then when you get to about 80 miles an hour, jumping off the car. That's kind of basically, if you want to find out what a high side feels like, then that's what you need to do. But please don't do it. It wasn't us that told you to do it. Not at all. I deny all responsibility. But yeah, I mean, I can think of one of my last ones was at the Boldores at Circuit Paul Ricard, coming around the fast right-hander, trying to build speed towards the Mistral, and the thing just let go. And, you know, it's just such a horrible thing, because you know, the thing goes and you know exactly what's going to happen. As soon as the tire goes and grips again, you know what's happening.
You were fully aware at the time?
Yeah, it's just that horrible, sickening feeling, because you've been there before, you know what's coming next. And then you're up in the sky and everything is really weird, because everything just goes quiet and it's nice up there, you know, it's all fine, but you know,
yeah, peaceful,
yeah, exactly. And it's really weird because it's like, oh, it's all nice up here, but you know what's coming, and then you hit the ground. Oh my god. And at that time at the Boulder, I was knocked out, knocked unconscious, and because this was in 89 or 90, I can't remember, on an RC30, and when I woke up, because I didn't care about that kind of thing then, you know, 30 seconds or a minute later, having been lying, you know, unconscious, I sort of got up and staggered around and found the bike. They put the bike up against the barriers, and the crash had wiped off both the front and the rear brake levers. So obviously it's an endurance race, you've got to get the bike back to the bits, you know. It started on electric start, because you have an electric start in endurance racing, thank god. Quite often it won't, because it's been upside down, and maybe the carburetors are fucking drained of gas and all that kind of stuff. And it started amazingly, and then I had to ride all the way back about 10 corners with no front brake or rear brake. So you're trying to keep off the track, trying to stay on the curb, but of course the fun came when I came into pit lane and couldn't stop. And you know, there's a couple of mechanics ready to receive you, assuming that you're going to stop with the brakes, but I just couldn't. I just had to ride into them, you know. I'd put it down to first gear and try to slow it down as much as I could, but just kind of, they all realized what was happening at the last minute, and I just rode into the poor bastards. Yeah, it didn't hurt anybody, but you know, and we carried on, and I went, they put me in bed, and after about 2-3 hours the team manager said, you got to, you know, we need you, we can't, you know, the two other two guys are completely screwed physically, so you got to go out, you know. So I got on, and I was feeling all dizzy and sick, and I was puking in the helmet, and oh, it was just horrible. I mean, really, really horrible. Going about a second and a half slower than normal, and vomiting in my helmet, and getting chills and everything. Well, yeah, concussion isn't a nice thing. Give us a nice high side story, Peter. Your best high side.
You want a front end or a rear end? I've got a couple.
I want a rear end high side. The worst one you ever had. The worst one you ever had.
No. Actually, I tell it from my point of view, because I never had a real race career. I can ride a bike or two, and I can say something about a bike, but let's forget about it. What I remember and what says more about me is I was analyzing it, and I was analyzing it while it was happening. So I was just thinking about it all the time, what happened. I was on a test on Assen for some motorbike magazine, like a group test, a lot of superbikes, 600, 1000, and it was even Aprilia RS250, and I was keen to get on that one, because I came from two-stroke motocross bike in my past. I became a Ducati guy afterwards, but then having a go on the track on a 250 two-stroke was just, you know, was a thing I looked for.
Nothing better in the world than a 250 GP bike. There will never be. There will never be.
Yeah, you told me all the time in your magazine. Yeah, I was all the, exactly. So I was having a go with it. I was quite disappointed in the engine brake capacity of that thing. I nearly shit myself coming into turn one and just gently easing off the throttle, and it's like opening it again. Okay, oh, fuck, brake, because the thing is not braking anything. You know, coming from big Ducatis, I was just feeding the throttle open and closing, and it was giving me a reasonable lap time. Not on that really, yeah. But anyway, a couple of laps later, I found out that there was a certain corner that used to be done in third gear, but the gearbox of that thing was not very nice. So that one, that famous one time, I came there and I felt a false neutral. So I jumped on it again. Looking in hindsight, wasn't very clever, because now suddenly I found myself a second gear. By the time I found the second gear, it was time to open the throttle. So I just whacked it open as I did before in third. And then I said, at the moment I was thinking, wow, that's high RPM. You know, the sequence of things, and it says more about me being quite slow in realizing things. The sequence of things, how I realized it, was not like I'm in trouble. I was like, that's high RPM. And then I'm like, okay, why is the handlebar in this position? And then suddenly a real hard kick under my ass, and I was just surprised. I was hanging in the air with a big question mark on top of me, not realizing. But like you said, everything was calm and peaceful. And then I started tumbling, and I realized that I counted the tumbles. I make again a comparison with data recording and with some other crashes that I had. What I noticed in my life is, as soon as something major happens, like falling off a roof or tumbling with a car, you know, we all got it, it's like my data recording suddenly goes from recognizing things 10 times a second, it goes to 200 times a second. Yeah. Suddenly you're fully aware. So a crash usually takes forever in your mind, because suddenly you start to register really. I remember thinking that's 2, 3, 4. And after 5, I started to become angry. I said, nah, there's no way on this crash, it wasn't that fast, I can have to tumble more than 5 times, 6, 7, 8. And suddenly I was there and realizing it, I've done 9 or 10. I counted all of them and I remember every second from it. But when it started, I wasn't that quick in realizing what was happening. But at the end, yeah, I realized and I counted all my tumbles all the time. I broke a couple of small bones in my foot or something, nothing major, nothing that kept me away from the other beautiful bikes the rest of the day. But yeah, that was how I realized it. So basically not, I just was thinking what's happening and then I was in the air. Not as sharp as you, Matt.
Excuse me laughing all the time, but that's what racers do with each other. They just, when another racer tells you about that crash, you just laugh the whole time. That's what we're like. We're mean bastards. I mean, you know, even if you don't hurt, like you say, even if you don't really hurt yourself, you know, I've high-sided, not broken things sometimes. And, you know, you're just tumbling down the track over and over and over again. And you're just, you know, that we swear on this podcast. So you're basically going, fuck, every time you tumble, because it really hurts. And then you sort of end up lying on the asphalt and there's bikes coming past like half a meter away from you at like 100 miles an hour. You're just like, please don't run over me. And and you can smell blood in your nose and everything. And oh, it's horrible. Anyway, that's enough of our personal experiences. Peter, I wanted to ask you about, we know that aerodynamics have, I mean, I know you're not crew chiefing at MotoGP, but we know that aerodynamics can cause crashes. You know, that, you know, we know, like, for example, I think one of the reasons Marquez crashed so much last year was because of Honda's new aero, which was very similar to KTM's from the year before. And I remember speaking to Brad Binder, 22, at Jerez, every time he went through the fucking fast double right before the final hairpin, which is a scary corner. There's not a lot of runoff there.
Oh, that corner. Yeah, these corners are amazing.
It's a scary, scary corner. And he said every lap he was losing the front through there because the aero was putting too much force, too much at that speed through a corner. It was putting too much load on the front. So the suspension was compressing too much and the front tire would start to slide every lap. And I thought, oh my God, that just sounds, I mean, that makes you realize once again what complete amazing riders these people are. That he was just, okay, I'm losing the front through here every lap, you know, and you're going to crash there. You're sort of fourth, fifth, you're going to get hurt. And he was just dealing with it. But I think that's one reason why Marquez crashed so often last year with that new aero. I could be completely wrong. But I mean, do you must speak to people. Do you hear other sort of talk of aero kind of causing people to lose the front or whatever?
Not from personal experience, but I have an opinion. But first start by what you say about he's about to crash every time they do that. Well, actually, if you speak a little bit longer with some riders after they've done some really amazing good laps, it's more or less, they don't say it in that way, but when they are really on top of the game, and these last three right-handers in Jerez, you know, are classics, because they're so unforgiving. They're so, you have to be dedicated, you have to be fully committed to it, and then you're just a passenger. Because it's not a corner you break, feel for your position, decide your turning in point. It's a quick movement, a very quick combination of just shortly closing the throttle, throwing your body in a very swift, but not too aggressive movement, completely to the side, and then going from curb to curb and praying that your actually don't after the curb. And when the riders are doing a really, really good lap, because these three corners are, you know, they are so important for the lap time, they sort of usually know what's going to happen. And this is not the same as I'm doing a very good lap. If they know their bike very well, they know I'm going to lose it here, but that's okay because it will come back because it did the last couple of laps as well. So if I don't do anything more, it's actually almost like if I don't lose it, I wasn't fast enough. And they know if the rider understands his bike and the tires and the situation very, very well, it's like in one beautiful harmony with each other, with everything. He knows it's going to go. He knows how it's going to feel and he knows it's all right because it will come back. Well, it's staggering thinking about it, but that's how they deal with it. Now over to the aerodynamics. Yeah, the aeros, what we see happening is that these Stegosaurus style things on the back of the rider, behind the back of the on the tail of the bike. One of the things they do is not that beautiful because they create dirty air. And that's probably the reason for some manufacturers to put them there. I know from one manufacturer for a fact that they don't use them because they know what it does and they don't want that. Even if they're not winning a lot. Okay, I'm quite cryptical here. I can't say anything more. but what it does is it sucks you in. So you're following another rider. You wanna break your way onto him or be getting close to him. And suddenly, first of all, you're in dirty air. So everything is really, really unstable. Because that's actually, I have to mind if I don't get too chaotic. The good thing aeros do, let's start with that, is stabilize shit. And that's nice. It stabilizes the whole bike, which is nice, but also more nice for less gifted riders than nice for really, really seriously fucking shit talented riders. Because they don't care. They can use it anyway. And then they can make the difference. So suddenly the bike's stable, which is, like I said, nice, but also makes it a little bit easy. But when you're on the wrong moment, on the wrong place, it's deadly. Because suddenly, first of all, you're in the dirty air and the thing is not that nice. And when you're just getting a little bit too close to him, you don't stop. It's like somebody put oil on your brake pads. I think that's a dangerous... I know that's a dangerous situation. We saw Alex Marquez nearly taking three riders out in Mugello last year just because of that. So yeah, aero is something we have to look in for that reason.
And at the end of last season, we saw it happen twice. Did Antonio and Pecco Bagnaia? Bagnaia was trying to pass. Or was trying to get close to set up a pass on at the end of the straight at
Qatar,
and nearly hit him. And it happened also at the final race with
Valencia,
with Jorge Martin and Pecco Bagnaia. The amazing thing is that, you know, you think these are really dangerous situations, but these riders are so fucking good that even at 220 miles an hour, they can still get out of trouble. You know, even though they're braking on the limit and they go into the vacuum behind the rider and somehow they miss the guy, but. I've been saying this for quite a while. It's not going to happen all the time. You know, I think we're going to get a horrible big high speed crash, which is a worry, which I'm not looking forward to. Finally, Peter, we know that traction control TC helps save crashes out of corners. You know, you can get high sides into corners, which are just as bad, even worse sometimes because the riders are less ready for them. And I mean, I know the engine braking control, the electronics, is kind of like an engine braking traction control, isn't it? Kind of. I mean, is there anything that they could do to reduce corner high sides more? It maybe yes, maybe no. I don't know. It's just a thought.
You mean corner entry high sides, Matt?
Corner entry high sides, yeah. So is there anything you could do with I mean, I know the electronics are kind of like a TC, aren't they? Going into a corner, they're meant to control, you know, not to have it locking up too much, not to have it too free. But I guess it would just need a particular setting, which might not be a fast setting with the engine braking electronics.
A high siding on corner entry is still possible, but it doesn't happen that often. I think it was Paul Espargaro in Portimao that had it happening to him on a cold tire as well. Well, hard to say how much influence you have there with electronics. It's clearly if you have way too much engine brake while having the rear light and being not in a straight line is a potentially dangerous situation. Usually riders use this or know how to handle it. The bike gets sideways on the corner entry and it can come back. Thinking about it, I think what we see more is crashes that start because the engine brake setting is not correct. If you have, for example, way too much negative torque on the rear tire, so you have a crazy engine brake, way too much, and the bike goes sideways, that looks spectacular, it's not very fast. But even if you are not really too late with the whole situation and still manage to get into the corner, there is a moment where the rear needs to come back in line with the front. That's just before you really start to turn in. You know, you have to verging towards the corner, goes into, okay, seriously committing to throw it on its side. That's the moment when the the tires have to be back in line. And when that coming back is quite aggressive, what it does is you don't lose the rear, but you still lose the front.
Yeah.
So when the rear comes back aggressively in line, it gives an extra spike of pressure on the front tire, and you can lose the front there. A very good moment to see that is Misano, the first really double, I think it's 1-2, turn 3. That's a good example to see that stuff happening, because it's also a very slow corner. Because we spoke about, I did some homework, you did some homework for this episode about crashing. The one thing I noticed is not only the crash statistic, but when I went over the track maps, and then for every track that we went to, they showed the one or two corners that were the most crashes. It's clearly, it's always either a slow corner or a really slow corner. There is a reason for that. I can explain that. Or when it's not a slow corner, when it's, for example, turn 2 in Austin, it's a really fast corner where Pecco Bagnaia crashed, leading the race before Alex Marquez, then it's a corner that is either off camber or it's a corner where you don't brake enough to put the load on the front tire. Like the famous position in, I think it's turn 11 in Valencia, we have a situation like that as well. So there's always a reason, but when the riders really overdo it and crashing, then it's 8 out of 10 times, I would say, a relative slow corner. And the reason is not because they're scared that they dare to put a little bit more there, because, okay, that's another subject. It's usually because when you come to a slow corner, you usually come from a relative high speed, so you're braking a long time. So it's easier to be a little bit too late, and then you're like a passenger on it. Too late, too late, too late. Still want to make it, because missing that corner is costing you a lot of lap time. If you go into a fast corner, you're half a meter offline, it's not nice, but you can sort of try to compensate for it. But that slow speed corner, then you ruin the exit from it as well. So you still want to try and hang on and try to make it. But the most important thing why we lose it, Matt, on slow speed corners is when it's gone, it's just immediately gone. The good thing from high speed is everything, the speed of the bike is fast, but the movements when things go wrong are like relatively slow. You can like you just explained yourself, if you lose the front in a low second gear corner, it's just one. It's gone. Before you know what happens, it's gone. If you're in fast in the fifth gear corner, you can feel it coming, you can feel the understeer, and still, you know, like you said, don't do anything, only pray, and maybe it will come back and save you. So that combination, when the low speed, when the front goes, it just goes. And that's for me the most important reason we lose it on slow speed corners. And then another thing I want to mention, now we are on 48 minutes, I know, so we have to stop. The 30
right.
minutes podcast was a dream, eh? We did it a couple of times probably, where we not managed to. The thing about the crashing number that you started with, Matt, is the one thing I don't think you mentioned, and I want to put it here, is that we crashed because we can, and we did not crash because we couldn't afford to. You were riding the old A1, the what is now called the Red Bull Ring.
Yeah.
Most of the places there, I'm sure, even in the endurance races you did there, people just don't crash, because if you know you can't crash, you keep a lot more reservation by everything you do.
Yeah, I mean, back then the Red Bull Ring was, I mean, I loved it. It was a super fast. I loved fast circuits much more than slow circuits, and the two or three corners that literally you came out to the Armco, just like a street circuit. So you just came out, and one year we were there, the factory Honda wiped off its footrests on the Armco coming out. You know how the guy didn't crash or lose a leg or something, I don't know, but you do not want to crash places like that. Yeah, and the safer you make the tracks, the more people will crash, but the less people will get hurt, and that's what matters.
Exactly, the tracks are safer, but the gear we have, Lou, the helmets or the shoots. Think about the leather shoots you were carrying in your time. I mean, Jesus, look at it now. It's a joke compared to what they are carrying now, and then even the airbags and everything that are on it now. So it's so much safer, and we seem to have even the young kids now, the racers, you have like a little calculation channel or a risk modulator inside how much risk you want to take. So the safer you make it, I just push a little bit harder. That's who we are, basically. We're animals, we're racers, and we look for the limit. So things got safer, so we crash more.
When I did the Isle of Man TT, I kind of, you know, there were some corners where you would risk 100% and others where you knew that if you crashed, you'd die. I mean, generally, if you were fighting for the win, you'd still might risk it 100%. But if you weren't, you know, you certainly wouldn't. You'd take that corner at 90% or whatever, you know. But anyway, right, we better wrap it up there. I mean, crashing is a big subject. You could go on about it forever, really. It's such a huge part of motorcycle racing. Kind of sadly, but, you know, that's what it's all about. It's living on the edge. That's what motorbike racing is all about. That's what it should be about. All right, everybody, thank you very much for listening. Thank you to Pete. Peter. Thank you to Sam for producing, as always. We'll be back next Sunday, which will be the Sunday before the first test of the year. Yay! Which Peter and I will be going to, snooping around, looking at the new bikes, talking to the riders, talking to the engineers. And around about that time, we're going to stick ourselves on Patreon. I think we're going to try and get ourselves on YouTube if we can get around to it. So yeah, lots of exciting stuff to come in and, you know, hopefully looking forward to a great new season. All right, everyone. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.